You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cuss.
Oh, friends, I have been excited about this interview, I mean, probably for months, because I think we've rescheduled like two or three times. But a couple of years ago when I first launched the podcast, I made a list of dream guests, and one of them that I really wanted to get on was Nancy Ortberg. We had never met, but in the course of the interview, we just really connected, and Nancy has since become, I think, far and away the number one advocate for my work and my book, so much so that her husband John and I have had what can best be described as a brooding and ongoing profound conflict about just Nancy's enjoyment of my book and my materials. I've written one book. John has written many books. And so Nancy came on. We had a great chat. We've had the privilege of doing some work together. And then John and I have been able to connect. And I said to both of them, I would love to get you guys on together, because Nancy and John, both individually and together, are a remarkable, I think, and rare combination of leadership, emotional well-being, spiritual well-being. So John and Nancy Ortberg, welcome to the Managing Leadership Anxiety podcast.
We are delighted to be with you, Steve. You do owe me money for hawking your books all around the world. So
she's delighted to be with you. I just get sick and tired of it. Steve Cuss, Steve Cuss, Steve Cuss. Read Steve Cuss. Listen to Steve Cuss. My hope is that she will get Steve Cuss out of her system by doing this podcast. So I have a whole different agenda for us.
Your work's profound.
That's right. Yeah, there's one. This could be a saboteur-based situation. The first time John and I met in person, John actually made me hold one of his books so that we could send a photo to Nancy just for something different. It was
every other picture of her is holding your book up.
Yeah, that's right. But listen, you guys have decades of faithful leadership and also a rare attention to people's well-being. Let's just start with each of you. When in your life did you first discover that your own soul shape is directly connected to your leadership health?
Boy, for me, it was when I was in college and I volunteered at the church that I was going to in the youth group. I think I was a whole year older than the seniors in high school, so I had so much to offer. And there was a youth pastor there who was just a great shepherd. And if I did something well, he would praise me and be specific. And if I messed up, it took me a couple of months to realize when he used the phrase, "If you could do that over again, what would you do differently?" And about the third or fourth time he said that to me, I was like, oh, he's coaching me on the gap, the miss. And he did it so lovingly and also out of belief that I could be a better leader, a better person, if I paid attention to that kind of feedback. So I was 19 or 20.
Yeah. Okay.
I think for me, it's been more of a journey. I've always been fascinated by change. How do people change? Why do people change? What does well-being look like? How does faith intersect? How does God intersect? Why is change so hard? For me, it was less the connection between that and leadership and just the word leadership itself. Nancy has much stronger leadership gifts than I do, although it was a many-decade journey to discover that and eventually recognize it and then be comfortable with it and then actually rejoice in it and trying to understand what is leadership exactly. Because I think there's so much confusion around that term and there are so many definitions of it. Is everybody is a leader? How does organizational leadership look different than just the exercise of dominion in life? So for me, I think a lot of the challenge and growth has been not so much this connection between inner life and leadership as coming to understand leadership itself.
Yeah. Yeah, here we are, you know, 3.5 years post-COVID, I suppose, or maybe a little less. And when I was an emergency room chaplain, one of the great lessons I was taught was that my job, like if you think about chaplaincy and the different aspects of it, you've got hospice chaplaincy, which is quite slow and deliberate. And but then emergency room chaplaincy was very visceral, very fast-paced. One of the veteran chaplains pulled me aside And he said, you know, your job when you go to meet the family, your job is to figure out what state were they in 1 minute before the phone rang, before they ever got that call. Whatever state they were in before that, the emergency reveals it or heightens it. Wow. I guess I feel the same way about COVID. I don't personally think COVID created much. I just think it exposed a lot. What do you guys see that it exposed? And then after that, where do you see leaders today? How are we doing? So first of all, for either of you guys, what do you think it exposed in us?
Well, I'll go first and then you can go. In the church, I would say the most obvious thing is in the U.S., we are simply in a state where trust in the institutional church or organized religion continues to decline. And people's sense of spirituality or faith is a little bit more ambiguous, but very clearly across the board, you know, people used to go to church or feel guilty for not going to church. That is decreasingly the case. And I think COVID gave everybody permission to go to church less. And for pastors, where it remains the case that if a church is reaching people, more folks are coming, there's a sense that that's probably a positive indicator. And if people stop coming, that's probably a negative indicator. There has just been a massive increase in negative feedback. And so I think that we're still living with that.
I think with the work I do in the San Francisco Bay Area with church leaders, a lot of what I'm hearing from them is the shock, surprise, and horror of what they perceived a primary allegiance in their congregation was political, not Jesus. And feeling bad that they had not discipled more deeply, but also realizing maybe it took a crisis to reveal that. And it has been very sobering for a lot of pastors in the Bay Area. And I think another thing that happened with racial tension, when George Floyd happened, we were all stuck at home and we couldn't look away. We couldn't. So we had to keep watching it over and over again until something like fear or anger or whatever emerged. And, you know, that led to all kinds of things during the global pandemic.
That's fascinating. I was an immigrant lead pastor for years. I wasn't able to vote as a non-citizen. I'm a citizen now, but for almost all of my lead pastoring, I thought it was very convenient for our church to have a immigrant pastor that couldn't vote, because people before 2016 and then before COVID, they didn't really hear me the same way. It was really wild.
Interesting.
After 2020, particularly, to suddenly be accused of so many things.
Wow.
I make it a habit of reading 1 Corinthians because it makes me feel better about my discipleship of our congregation. But that was really humbling to realize how many of our people had, I guess, what I would describe as a thin veneer of discipleship with a fairly hefty political ideology.
Right.
Yeah.
Clearly.
So, Nancy, you're continuing to work with leaders. How's their soul health in a general sense?
Such a great question. Obviously, during the pandemic, it just took such a hit. I had one young pastor of a fairly large church for the Bay Area talk to me and say, in the pandemic, on Monday, he had a family come to him and say, "We're leaving because you talk about the social gospel too much." And on Friday, he had another family come and said, "We're leaving because you don't talk about it enough." And like, what do you do with that? They felt stuck in the middle of such great tensions on either side, political, racially, response to the pandemic. People's fear had just escalated in, you know, some of the work you've done. They were so reactionary, they could hardly have conversations. Obviously, during the pandemic, some of the polls that we've seen had such a high percentage of pastors considering leaving the ministry. As a counter to that, what's interesting is I read an article that said actually in the corporate world, the percentage was higher. So when that standalone survey comes back, we get alarmed, but actually corporate had a higher percentage. And of the 48 to 63% of pastors that were thinking about leaving, I've yet to see a survey that says any great percentage have. Some have. But I think the vast majority of what I've seen in the Bay Area is they've gone through this really, really, really difficult time. And they've found some resolve somewhere inside of them to say, this is when leadership counts. that when we're old men and women, young leaders are going to ask us, what was it like to lead during COVID? And coming out of COVID, I think after about 6 months, I started to see this resolve and spirit of joy return to them to rethink church and to move forward. So I'm quite encouraged at this point.
Yeah. And John, you're traveling around and spending quite a bit of time on Zoom and in person with leaders. What are you seeing nowadays?
This is all anecdotal. It's hard to get good data on this information. But I would say in general, there's still a sense from pastors that I'll talk with that their most kind of visceral, obvious way of gauging church effectiveness was attendance. And when you're preaching, it's nice to be able to look into eyes and read body language and get feedback in that way. And that it has declined since COVID, and it still has not gone back up. And so I think there's still folks, I would say, that I talk with, people struggling to try to figure out, how do I gauge how effective we're being as a church? And I don't want to feel like the best we can do is just try to get back to as close as where we used to be. I remember playing tennis years ago with a guy who had been a really, really good tennis player when he was younger. And he was saying now mostly he plays golf. And he said the reason for it is with golf, I can keep getting better. With tennis, the best I can do is deteriorate as slowly as possible. I think that, being in the evangelical tradition, we used to sometimes think with some smugness, I think, about some of the mainline denominations in the U.S., that there was just this sense that they were deteriorating. And now there's this sense within almost all church communities, including evangelical ones, of, I don't even know if it's ever going to be able to get back to where it was before COVID. So what do I do with that? So I think that question is on the mind of folks that I talk with.
Absolutely. Yeah. The podcast is notorious or famous for a gauntlet of anxiety questions. Nancy, you have bravely navigated the gauntlet once. John, this being your first time, I know even as I speak about it, the fear and the dread that comes with it. What I wanted to do with you guys is actually do a deeper gauntlet than I normally do. Typically with my episodes at the end, we kind of do a rapid fire thing. But I've now collected over the 3 or 4 years of the podcast 19 questions that I ask in the gauntlet. I don't think we'll get through all 19, but I'd just like to grab some random ones and see what you guys are thinking about this. Because when I think of any given Ortberg, what I think about is somebody who is passionate about the gospel and integrated in a life and also a tremendous authenticity. So I think it'd be interesting to get more of gauntlet out of you guys. So if you don't mind bracing yourself like a man or a woman, if you are one, in the wonderful words of Colin Hay. Does that reference mean anything to you guys, little Australian singer-songwriter Colin Hay? I was afraid it wouldn't. Also, probably only 3% of my audience. But for those who love the song Down Under, Men at Work, the lead singer is Colin Hay. I'm going to leave that there.
Good to know.
No, stay with it for a little while.
Yeah, I think I might send you guys a sample song after this.
Please do.
Let's kick off with one of my simple favorite questions. Nancy, if you'd be so kind as to go first, how do you know when you're not well?
Oh, boy. I love your stuff out of your book, your head, your stomach, and your heart, kind of paying attention to my body. I think I will often notice that if I'm overthinking or if I'm avoiding. And those seem pretty opposite, and they are, but they're just different ways of coping with, I don't have an answer, I feel shut down, I'm overwhelmed, I can spiral into overthinking in ways that are so not helpful. Or I can just find myself avoiding the important work I need to get to and getting busy around peripheral things as a way of quelling my anxiety.
Yeah. John, how about for you?
I have a framework that I try to use, although I think often I don't. Many, many years ago, I asked Dallas Willard, who's kind of a mentor, about how do you know if you're doing well? Because I grew up in a tradition where somebody asked, particularly, how's your spiritual life going? I would always think first, am I having a quiet time? Is it regular? And then I realized You know, in Jesus' day, if you looked at devotional practices as the measure of doing well, the Pharisees had come out on top. So that's not a real good measure. So I asked Ellis, well, if that's not the best measure, how do you know how you're doing? And his immediate response was, I ask myself if I'm getting more or less irritable these days. And am I becoming more or less easily discouraged? Because if I'm living in the love of God, I will just not be increasingly irritated. And if the peace of Christ really is at home in my heart, it will be harder to get discouraged. And I thought that was a really, really helpful, very simple way of looking at well-being. So I try to use those. I do find, just as you were talking, I think probably the quickest trap I fall into is just unawareness. I will be deeply engrossed by a thought or a feeling or something that's troubling me and not even really being aware of it enough to look at it.
John, when you sit down with Dallas Willard and you ask the sign and he says irritability, does that answer irritate you?
Oh, that's good.
It used to, but now that I'm doing better, it doesn't.
Yeah, I feel like one of the signs that I'm not well is when I hear Dallas Willard say, you should measure your irritability, and that irritates me. Then I'm like, oh, I think I must not be well.
I like it.
I think one of the things that's common with all of us is there's just certain kinds of people that, quite frankly, are harder to love. The only reason we love them is Jesus said we had to do it. And it seems to be personality traits or behaviors. And it's always the same personality traits or the same behaviors. So what types of people would trigger each of you the most?
For me, too. Somebody who's very needy and keeps looking to me over and over again to try to fill those needs. And somebody who's mean. Just somebody who's mean, I find myself kind of leaning away from. And I ought to be leaning towards.
I mean, you know, when you say that, yes, those both strike me as really hard people to love. If I was going to add another category, it might be somebody where it feels like they're misusing power. You know, because I think then I would find both anger, but if they were in a position of power in my life, also fear. And then I would feel a sense of shame and what's the matter with you for being afraid of this person? So I think that one is probably pretty layered for me.
Okay. I feel like one of the reasons to do this difficult work is, unfortunately, to broaden my capacity to connect with difficult people.
Yes.
I find in my life, if somebody is very difficult or irritating, I turn them into a monster in my head. I have an anger fantasy about them. I'm always right. They're always wrong. I personally move into a fairly disturbing level of self-righteousness, to be honest. It's taken quite a bit of work for me to get past my initial judgment and find a way to connect to them.
Yes.
Do you guys have a practice that helps you get past this initial thing and connect to them and remember that they're human?
Well, what I was going to say too is that with those types of people, whatever they are for you, I think sometimes we can get overly therapeutic and start setting boundaries around people like that, when actually what we need to do is to drop the boundaries a bit and engage. Maybe less than I might engage with somebody else because my capacity is not as large with those types of people, because those are the kind that are hardest for me. But to think every person has a story. Every person has a reason why they are the way they are. I'm on somebody else's list for being that kind of person that's difficult. And how can I move towards them even for just a minute or two? More, which is more than I might, and deem that a success.
So two things for me. One is an old one from AA in the 12 steps. Mm-hmm. When you are aware of kind of judgmentalism and anger towards others, is just to try to remember they also are a sick person, that we're all sick people. We are all the victims of wrongdoing that has been done to us. In going through stuff in our life where there's people that are in that category that are really difficult, sometimes I've heard it said, everybody's doing the best they can. And I don't find that helpful. I don't think everybody is doing the best they can, because I know I'm not doing the best I can. But then somebody said, everybody thinks what they're doing is right. And that makes sense. Yeah. We've been listening to detective books about this detective Ganache. Is it Ganache? And I was just listening to the other one.
We're not supposed to listen to that without
it. So just deal with it.
And, rewind.
Part of what makes him, you know, every detective kind of has their own superpower. With him, it's empathy. And he is a great listener. And there's a wonderful section in the second book that talks about everything makes sense. To the person who does it, everything makes sense. Mm-hmm. And even murder, if we think about it, is just, this is this terrible person. No one ever says to themselves, now I'm going to go do something wicked. What people do always makes sense to them. And so just to remember that about another person. And then I've just been reading, Steve, you probably know a good bit about this, about a scale called IOS, Inclusion of Other in the Self. And it's just a series of seven pairs of circles. It goes back like 35 years and has been used hundreds of times. It's super simple. At one end, you have two circles that are, as you can see, I've just now drawn this, not
very impressive
at all. And then there's a series of them until you have two circles that are almost entirely overlapping. And you can rate any relationship. When I think about that person, are they like this, where I don't have any empathy towards them? They're not internalized in me at all. No, I want to rejoice when they rejoice. I want to mourn when they mourn. And there's that little scale of, to what extent have I included this other in myself, I thought was really interesting from a spiritual perspective, and is kind of interesting to begin to do with people in my life.
And maybe even those first two circles, some space between them, where you've got space between them. I think it takes us back to when Jesus says, what good is it if you love people that love you? That's love 101.
Yeah.
You get no credit for that. So it's the hard work of love is to move towards people that are difficult for us.
Boy, there's so much in what you guys both just said. I actually want to camp on this for a little bit. So if I can start in reverse with what you said, John, this people are throwing this around a lot nowadays. Hey, everyone's doing the best they can. And I really appreciate the way you fleshed that out, because I have a relationship in my life right now that's quite challenging. And I don't believe this person's doing the best they can at all. Actually, a lot of the challenge is those of us who love him think you could actually try a lot harder.
That's right.
But when you reframed it and said, but this person is doing what they really do think is right. I think that's true. They're operating however that is. But also, Nancy, something that you threw in there, I run into so many people who use boundary language hours or weeks before they need to be talking about boundaries. I want to say that I think Henry Cloud and Townsend's work on boundaries was revolutionary, helpful. They're particularly when you're talking about abuse, toxic behavior, long-term patterns, particularly people like me who tend to get enmeshed. When I see your Venn diagrams there, John, I think, oh, my problem is I let way too many people in. Mm-hmm. That you know, and then therefore overcommit and get worn out or whatever. Yeah. But so many people nowadays are using boundary language to avoid the difficult work of connection. I'd just love to hear more from you guys on that.
Well, I think it's interesting that a book like Boundaries has sold so much. If you think about the opposite, it would be connecting or whatever that's going to be. there's no book on that topic that has sold anywhere near. It's much more attractive and compelling to think, oh, I can say no to demands on my life. I don't have to serve in this way. I don't have to worry about what this person is thinking or experiencing. And again, all of those boundaries may be very necessary and an important part of growth. But often there will be an appeal to that, because then I am pushing more stuff off my plate as opposed to the obligation of love. And it's just interesting that there's no book on that subject that is going to sell nearly that much.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things I'm thinking about as I think about boundaries, and let me say it and see, maybe Nancy will get your reaction to this. Does this ring true for you? There have been a small handful of times where I've had to put a boundary for safety or well-being, but one of the measurements is it's not in that person's best interest either to keep the toxic relationship. So, for example, I've had, as a pastor, I've had a small handful of people mistreat me horribly, not because I'm Steve, but because I'm a lead pastor and they have all of this assumption about me. And I remember one of them, I talked to him and I said, "You're the first person I've ever blocked the email from. Like, I've never blocked anybody's email, but I'm blocking yours because I don't think it's good for you either to be sending me the stuff you're sending me. I don't think it's good for your soul. It hurts me. It's very hurtful to me. Mm-hmm. But I'm blocking you for your sake as well." How does that strike you guys that maybe one of the ways to measure boundary language is it's also best for the person? Even, for example, an abuser, it is not good for the abuser to get away with the abuse. No. Therefore, a boundary is actually helpful. Nancy, what's your reaction to that?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think if Henry and John were here right now, they would agree that you can take boundaries too far. But there is something to which you say is both of us need a timeout. It's a little bit like trying to make that verse, "Never let the sun go down on your wrath," be the overarching theme for a marriage. And all of us know sometimes we need a break from each other.
Yeah.
To get rid of the reactivity, to calm down, to find our center with God and to reengage. So I wonder if that protective boundary is necessary, but maybe there needs to be a time limit. And maybe I'll check back in a few months when we both had time to think and reflect and pray, and we can try again.
Yeah. Okay. Well, related to all this, it's on the gauntlet as well as criticism. I don't know a single leader that doesn't struggle with criticism on some level. Some of us are thinner skin than others, but John, let's go to you. What type of criticism most affects you?
You know, I think having preached for so long, criticism around preaching certainly does. And I think for pastors, there's a unique dimension because it can be hard to have my competence criticized, period. But then when it's preaching and spiritual leadership, that gets to my spiritual life. And
your identity.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. And do I love God deeply? Am I spiritually immature? Criticism that, you're not feeding me. It's the wrong kind of sermons. You don't really know God. You're not helping people to get to know God better. So I think criticisms that are related to spiritual life and identity, those would be the hardest ones. And something that was super helpful to me years ago, I had an elder say, when you're getting feedback — he was talking particularly about feedback from elders, but I think it's for criticism in general — he said, the hardest people to give feedback to are feelers. And I'm very much a feeler emotionally, because he said, in giving feedback, you got to get somebody's attention enough so that they're really taking you seriously, but not flood them so much that they get tanked. And he said, if somebody's a thinker, if you give them a warning that's at a 2 or a 3, they'll probably be paying attention, but you got to go up to 8 or 9 before they start getting tanked. With somebody who's a feeler, it's a real narrow window. It's like, you know, you got to get to 6 before you get their attention. At 6.5, they're getting flooded. So when you're getting feedback, including criticism, one of the phrases that a therapist that I have worked with uses a lot is the importance of don't take it personal. When criticism or feedback comes in, think about it, see if I can learn from it. But that little phrase, don't take it personal, don't assume that my worth as a human being is on the line with it. I have to remind myself of that a lot.
John, do you think preaching is more vulnerable than singing?
Yeah.
That's a great sentence.
Yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
I think it is too. It took me a while to realize, like, why am I so exposed after I preached a sermon to the point where sometimes it takes great effort to get down front for folks who want to visit or head to the lobby? Oh. And the longer I preached, the harder it got. I actually developed almost a social anxiety almost a preemptive thing. And I came to the conclusion, I wonder if preaching is actually a more vulnerable experience than standing on a stage and singing, because it is so personally tied to your spiritual life yourself.
Yeah. No, I think you are incredibly vulnerable when you're preaching. And
well, I was going to say, too, there's, I think for all of us, and you guys have preached more on a regular basis, but there's often a sense of when I'm done with a sermon, the spirit has gone out of me and I have lost capacity. I am spent a bit and not maybe in the best place to do superficial conversation with people for half an hour before I have to return to the seriousness of the next service and the message.
And
yeah, I've also struggled, Nancy, with I preach the sermon and maybe somebody wants to be prayed for with cancer. Maybe they just got a cancer diagnosis. And I'm still hopped up on adrenaline.
Right.
And I'm repenting of my message. I'm thinking, I'm like, oh, I should have said that differently. And just, it does feel like a massive disservice to people, or it takes me tremendous energy to deeply connect and flip from, not performer, of course, but still there is a performance element, to then kind of that counselor role. It's
well,
a real...
That's where I think the vision of a team is so important, to have people whose primary gift is intercession, who are not spent at that moment. And people are going to want to have you pray for them and to say, actually, here's a picture of the body of Christ. I'm not in the best position to pray right now with you. So what we have here are people who are fresh and engaged and gifted for that, and to graciously turn it over to them.
I think it's partly, you know, there's always a dark side to gifts. And so, because I love to communicate, I can have a more sensitive radar, be able to figure out what's going on in the room. How do I respond to that? When do I need to add humor or challenge people or change pace? But then the dark side of that is, I can feel like my own well-being is on the line. So if I think the message went great, I'm glad to stick around and talk to everybody as long as they want to. As you got a problem, come on up. But then when I feel like it went bad, there's this deep sense of something very much like shame. And I don't want to talk to anybody. And it's really hard. And what I aim at, coming back to Dallas Willard, Dallas said when he was a young man preaching one time, when he got up to preach, he said he sensed the Lord saying to him, remember, it's what I do with the words after they leave your mouth, before they hit people's ears, that matter. And it was striking being with Dallas, watching him preach. When he was done teaching, I never saw, he just genuinely, it was not in his body. He wasn't elated if it went well. He wasn't downcast if it went badly. He would talk a lot about, we're not meant to live under the burden of outcomes. We're not meant to carry outcomes. And that had gotten into him at the cellular level pretty deeply. I'm still a long ways away from that, but it gives me something to shoot for.
It's really good. Really good.
It was somewhere between 2003 and 2005. I don't remember when, but I was working at this wonderful church in Las Vegas, and we had like a staff and leadership care evening. My wife and I went. We were both pretty spent. And John, there was a video of you and Dallas Willard and Richard Foster, the three of you in a fairly freewheeling conversation. You may or may not remember it. And you told that story about Dallas with him there. And there's many ways where it kind of saved my preaching. Like it suddenly made sense. And I was at an event where Dallas spoke, and I find him to be profound is obviously an understatement, but that particular talk was not great. Right. It was not amazing. Mm-hmm. He was not always a compelling speaker. Like his words were, but his delivery. And I had in my head, John Ortberg said that he really doesn't care. He leaves the outcomes. And I watched it in real time. Mm-hmm. Wow. And walk off the stage completely relaxed. And I knew there is somebody that has something that I desperately need. There's life. That's what freedom looks like. It was, as a preacher, all wrapped up in performance and everything, that was a profound journey for me.
Steve, you actually taught me one of my favorite spiritual disciplines, and you will love this because you often think of spiritual disciplines as a very small number of little compartmentalized things. Steve, one time, In order to gain freedom, a discipline is something you can do by direct effort to gain the power to do what you can't. In order to gain more freedom from outcomes in preaching, deliberately preached a really bad sermon. And just structure of it didn't make sense. One idea didn't follow another. Poorly organized, bad illustrations. Just to experience, I can do this and still survive at the
end.
And
I'm still okay in love.
Yeah, I love that story.
One of the most profound moments of my life, getting up the next week to preach and everyone came back. And since we are knocking this around, what was fascinating to me, and obviously this is some of the work I do, is all of the assumptions I held about preaching were that, oh, this has to be such a good message, when in reality, this church had hired a young, inexperienced preacher. Mm-hmm. They had sat through so many bad sermons of mine. Like, how many weeks were these saints sitting there saying, you know what, he's a nice kid, he's really trying. Mm-hmm. We've got friendships here. We received communion today. We've got what we need. Maybe next week, you know. But in my mind, it was always a command performance. So, yeah, preaching, I often prescribe for preachers, and they're absolutely mortified by the idea. And I just keep trying to tell them, I'm like, it's not that you're doing amazing every week anyway. Just go ahead and hack the system and do a really bad one and discover that very little will change. Yeah.
Well, and we're actually doing a really bad interview right now.
Yeah, just to make the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
But let's get into your inner life, and then we'll just take a little break here. I'm fascinated by the question, what if I were at least as blank to myself as God is? Mm-hmm. What if I were at least as blank to myself as God is? Nancy, what would the blank be for you?
Kind. If I was as kind and not lost in, you're not doing enough, you need to do it better, you need to do more. I think the kindness of God, if I could internalize that more for myself, I do it pretty easily for others, it sometimes seems, but not always for myself.
John, how about for you?
Honestly, that was the word that came screaming as soon as you asked the question. Just
kind.
Like just immediately, number one. Yeah, so there's something deep in that. Yeah. I'm not sure what it is. And it doesn't mean that God isn't or shouldn't be, you know, deeply challenging. And the notion that we're accountable to God is amazing. And I was telling Nance, I was on a walk with a friend recently, and it just struck me, this person's quite tough, and I need to be tough going through a difficult situation. Toughness of spirit is something that I admire. So somehow the kindness of God must not be disassociated with all those things. But that was my first response. I think God would be kind toward me. And it's not that I don't pamper myself or, you know, love myself sometimes in even wrong ways or overly, but there's a lack of kindness there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think so much of our lifelong journey with God is unlearning the images we have of him that are wrong. And then having my mind talk to my brain to challenge my thinking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the book of Psalm, the Hebrew word means praise, but mathematically there are 2/3 psalms of lament to 1/3 psalm of praise, which to me means the way to authentic praise, not superficial chirpy praise, is through lament. And so this journey of I can't absorb God's kindness unless I can first challenge it. And going through hard times, I've had people say, you know, God is good. And I will just say out loud, all evidence to the contrary today. I don't see it. And you have good precedent for that all throughout Psalm. May my enemy's first child be stillborn.
Right.
This too is the word of the Lord. And right. So how do I descend into the lament and the pain and the chaos and the turmoil to test the kingdom, to see, is this really true? And I probably have to do it 32 to 76 times a day. But that's the journey for it to be real.
I have a friend named Mandy Smith. You guys may or may not be familiar with her. She's a pastor. She wrote this amazing book called The Vulnerable Pastor. Mm-hmm. And she was quoting St. Teresa of Avila, all shall be well and all manner of things shall be well. And then she added, in order to live that way, I require the broadest possible definition of all and well. I thought that was...
St. Teresa has been smoking dope that day.
Yes.
I mean, just to challenge these thoughts instead of to try to swallow them and chirp out what you think you ought to say, that doesn't... That's behavioral modification. It's just external change. It's not internal change.
Yeah. Oh, I love that you guys are banging the gong of kindness. One of my more recent tools I've been developing for people in my workshops is making sure you put yourself on your conscious list of relationships. So I make people actually write down that they're in, like, so if you're at a party and someone says, oh, do you have a family? You'd say, yeah, well, there's me. And then you'd add your family. It's like absurd. It's playful. But then I ask them to list how they treat their friends and people they love. And then list how they treat themselves. And this is out of my own life. I happily call myself stupid. I would never call anyone else stupid. I would never do that. I call myself a moron on a regular basis. But also on a deeper level, I check in with my friends a lot. I'm actually quite a good friend to my friends. I don't check in with myself. If you treated yourself as well as you treated others, what one way of dealing with yourself would change?
I would be very encouraging. So I love doing that with my friends. I love pointing things out in them that I just think are amazing and really have very little capacity to do that for myself most of the time.
I think I'm a 3 on the Enneagram, so I will constantly feel the pressure to be productive. And when I am with my friends, usually I'm not trying to get them to get something done. I just enjoy being with them. But when I'm with me, I usually feel like I have to be producing something or it's not good. So I think probably less obsessed with producing.
Okay, as many of my regular listeners know, lately I've been obsessed with the question, can I experience from God what I most deeply believe about God? I'm just so struck that I, as a former unchurched person, I have bet my whole life that Jesus sets me free, and yet when I look at my life, I don't feel free very often. I have bet my whole life that God loves me, but up until recently, I've struggled to experience the love of God for myself. I've been very good at proclaiming it to others and struggled to experience it myself. And that's why October 2nd through 4th, we're hosting the Unlocking Faith Conference. It's really not like any other conference you've been to in that we are bringing in people like Dr. Chuck DeGroat. My wife, Lisa, that many people don't know, but is a first-class trauma therapist. People fly in from all over the country to spend a week with Lisa to unlock their trauma. What we're going to be doing at this conference is we're going to be giving you unique keys. And some of the keys will fit and some won't. We're going to give you a number of keys where you can come away with 3 or 4 keys that can help unlock what is blocking you from experiencing what you believe about God. The conference is all about freedom, relief, breakthrough, getting off the treadmill of more of the same and try harder, and finding ways that we can enjoy the God that we believe in. October 2nd through 4th, we still have tickets for here in Colorado. If you want to join us in person, it's going to be a hoot. We're hosting it at our home church here in Discovery Church in Broomfield. But also, you can join us live streaming. And even if that timeline doesn't work out, we've got some people from all over the world joining in, that's fine. You can watch on demand. Every session will be recorded, and you can buy an on demand or a live streaming ticket. As I mentioned, Dr. Chuck DeGroat, one of my favorite humans, is visiting us and joining. But so are Andy Gullihorn and Jill Phillips. It's important to us to have some beauty at this conference. And so they are two of my favorite singer-songwriters, husband and wife, wickedly funny and also profound. And so come join us for the Unlocking Faith Conference. You can go to capablelife.me to get your tickets. Okay, John and Nancy, let's just turn the gauntlet to a bit more fun. I think we'll do three more questions. Number one, would you share a time when you witnessed a miracle? The reason I ask this is, like John, I'm a deep feeler, but I'm very feeling repressed. I think, I don't know if that's common, John, with Enneagram 3s, but I take in the world through feelings and then I quickly kick to my brain. And what I've noticed in my own life is how I cognitively discount miracles because I'm afraid of being let down by God. And so I love to learn and listen to people. There may or may not be a story. When have you witnessed a miracle?
It's such a loaded word, isn't it? Because it comes with the idea that somebody got miraculously healed of a terrible disease in a moment, or a Down syndrome baby immediately got turned into a normal baby. I've never seen anything like that. I think for me, very typically would be the birth of each of my children, of just not knowing what to expect. And in the first 5 seconds of giving birth to Laura, feeling this overwhelming love for somebody who had done nothing for me. And then the sense of I would kill for this person. It took me by surprise, the ferocity of my response.
Yeah, not many atheists in the labor and delivery room.
Not many.
Yeah. John, how about you?
Yeah, I remember reading in C.S. Lewis, I think it was in his book Miracles, where he talks about, you know, the supernatural suspension of the law of cause and effect. And he says in the course of writing that, he's never seen that. And I was very comforted by that because I thought, oh, I didn't know that you were a Christian and could say that you had not seen that. Yeah. So it was actually quite helpful to me because I never have. And I always find if I feel the pressure to want to manufacture or force, here's a circumstance that I can clearly say, you know, is like Jesus cleansing the leper or Moses parting the Red Sea. I would feel forced. I would feel like I was trying to make a claim that was stronger than what I actually do. And that actually becomes damaging to my faith. Because then deep down inside, I'll feel like, well, yeah, but secretly, I don't believe as much as I'm saying that I do. I certainly believe that just personhood, that people can choose and they have a free will, is something that it doesn't fit with a real mechanistic, naturalistic view of the universe. So that just the existence of persons is supernatural or miraculous in that way because people have freedom, and that transcends the law of cause and effect. And that's, I think, part of why we sense that with a birth. But in the way that would often be described kind of in the church, where just real clear-cut suspension of the laws of cause and effect. Nope, there's no situation that I could point to that would be very clearly that.
Yeah. One of the habits I'm trying to cultivate is I'm trying to notice in my body when I feel free. I believe Jesus set me free, and yet I do tend to get wrapped up. Mm-hmm. When recently have you felt fully free? There's all kinds of ways you can answer. What were you doing, or what did it feel like? When recently have you felt free?
You know, we were surfing 2 weeks ago, and there's just
pretty badly my part. But
small waves, big boards, not a very often. But
Nancy, you were on the podcast in, I think, 2019, and you told me then that you've never loved something you're so bad at. Is that still the case?
If you saw me, you'd think that's cute. She learned last week.
Okay.
It's the truth. Right. It's just the truth.
Right. Sorry, John, please continue.
No. Just seeing a wave come in, paddling, catching it, popping up, riding on it. It's like for those few moments, there's nothing else in the world going on except just this experience of nature, aliveness, movement, water, sun. So that was a moment of freedom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nature, for sure. What John just described, absolutely. Also, a meal outdoors with a good friend and a deep conversation. Just feel like this could go on forever and I would be happy. And I think part of what you're saying is when you can lose track of time, it's very theologically profound that the world is still spinning on its axis and I'm not making that happen. And I am free from the burden of running the world.
Oh, good. And then final question, if you are feeling fully loved by another human being, what's one thing maybe that they're doing?
I find with John just consistently his ability to listen to me and take in if I'm feeling anxious or concerned about something, and then his reiteration over and over again of, I'm here for you. That will never change. I love you. It's pretty safe. It's pretty safe.
Yeah. And I think being seen, just a sense of, Nancy and I constantly bicker about books because I want more of them. I want to have them around. She wants to get rid of them.
Too many.
I feel like a bookcase is a bookcase. It's not a vase case. It's not a picture case. It's going to be filled with books. And so she will want me to get rid of books all the time. And then I mentioned, I don't know, a month ago, there's a new book out about Lincoln's faith. And I love reading about Lincoln. And 2 days later, Nancy goes, ta-da, and she has ordered that book. And so there's just this sense of, oh, she was listening and she was noticing, and not just that, she wanted to do something for me. And not just that, it's actually something that runs a bit against her general theory of bookcases.
I love books, but there comes a point.
So I think it's feeling like somebody sees me and doesn't just see, but cares.
Yeah, so good. It does make me think of that meme. I don't know if you've seen it, John. Jesus is standing with a in this case, a man who loves books, much like he stood with a woman at the well in John chapter 4. And the man has a book in his hand. He's trying to buy it. And Jesus says to the man, you are right when you say you do not have this book. You have five other books at home that you have.
Thank you for that, Steve. Yeah. We will
send I'll send it along.
Yeah. Thank you.
Folks, my friends are John and Nancy Ortberg. They just naturally bring a wisdom that we all need. They have lived decades of faithful leadership in the kingdom of God, and their passion hasn't waned for it. And I'm not that much younger than them, but my life has been profoundly shaped by both of them. The way they are in this world, of course, what they say, as you picked up on this, but also just their posture in this world. So John and Nancy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Steve, it's been a joy. Yeah. Every time we're together, I just find myself filled with joy. Yeah. And I love you. I love your mind. I love the way that you think about stuff. I love any chance we have to have a conversation together. I love your spirit, your approach to faith. So thank you very much for letting us do this together with you.
Yes, absolutely.
That's truly, truly a pleasure for me.
And I just think this work you do is so profound. This conference, if we had more conferences like this, I think it could get to the heart of what's wrong with all of us and change things in our family, in our leadership, in our church, in our world.
Can I say a word about that?
Sure.
You can edit this out when you're broadcasting, but I was thinking as you were talking about it, it's such a great question about how are you not experiencing in God, or what are you experiencing and what do you believe? And I actually think part of what it points to is, to a large extent, we don't know what we really believe. And Dallas used to talk about this quite a lot, that your belief, he would say, actually, you believe something when you are prepared to act as though it's true. So if you believe in gravity, the ultimate level of belief is our mental map about how things are, and we never violate that, and that most pastors would be shocked if they knew what the people in their church actually believe, or if they knew what we believe. So I think when you get to that question of how do you experience God, what you're finding out, there's not actually a variance between what people experience with God versus what they believe about God. It's just that what we profess about God or think we're supposed to believe about God ends up being different than what we actually believe. And when we ask the question of experience, it's actually revealing what we really do believe about God. Yeah. And until we get to that level of coming to learn, what do I actually believe about him? We can't do change. We just do behavior modification. Yeah. And that's why I think Jesus was always aiming at the level of the mental map. Mm-hmm. When that gets changed, you don't have to bring people back to church every week to pump them up. I remember church where we used to be at, and it's like the theory of spiritual life was their vision leaks, so we got to bring them back every week to pump them up more with vision. And the problem with that is it's avoiding the issue of what's their mental map of reality. And if you come to believe that God is good and powerful the way that you believe in gravity, you will just live it out. So that, I think that conference is
necessary.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that postscript is staying in the podcast for sure. It's such a helpful way to see it. And obviously I'm currently failing at ending this podcast. But yeah, what happened for me was the more I study systems theory, I just keep trying to boil down, you know, what is it? So many people maybe have even heard of systems theory, but they don't really know what it is because most systems theorists are very ethereal when they talk about it. Ed Friedman, people like that. And so right or wrong, I boiled it down to four things. I thought there's four dynamics that damage every relationship we have, and that's assumptions, reactivity, stuck recurring patterns, like the epic bookshelf battle, or on a more practical level for parents trying to get your child out to school in the morning. That's a stuck recurring pattern. So it's assumptions, reactivity, stuck patterns, and then attempted solutions. One of the finest therapists in the world who practiced just down the road from you guys at the Mental Research Institute, Jay Haley, he says, we don't fix problems, we address attempted solutions. Mm. And I think I just woke up one day thinking, if those are the dynamics that infect my human relationships, I wonder how they're infecting my relationship with God. And thus the conference was born. So yeah, we're excited about it. It's going to be a boutique small conference, but we're pumped to host it.
Good. It's so good.
All right.
Thanks for having us.
For more resources, visit stevecussworts.com or missyoualliance.org.